Hi, this is Paul Slatkis, Good News Planet, speaking to Leonard Perlmutter. Hello, Leonard. How are you?
Very, very well. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a big honor for me to invite you. Actually, you know, I know you've spoken with lots of people over the years, and actually a long time ago, I believe I spoke with you.
You've been involved with the
World of Heart and Science of Yoga. This is your new book or your revised, or you just keep on revising yourself.
Well, that's true. I do. Everything is always fresh and always new, so I have new ways of looking at things all the time, and I'd like to share that.
The American Meditation Institute's Empowering Self-Care Program for a Happy, Healthy, Joyful Life. Okay. And you wrote this with Jenice Cortez Perlmutter. You know her?
I do know her. I met her many years ago, and she's been my wife now for 40 years.
All righty. Good news. We're starting off real strong here. You got some of the greats in the world here saying the book curriculum is endorsed by the iconic, I will agree, medical pioneers, Dean Ornish, Mehmet Oz, Bernie Siegel, Larry Dossey, and Leonard Perlmutter is with them as well. So tell us about the Institute and about your latest book.
Well, the Institute really became an outgrowth of our practice and then our teaching. It was a way to present this ancient wisdom that has come through to us from the oldest continuous spiritual and meditation tradition in the world, originally an oral tradition, and I learned it from my meditation master, Swami Rama of the Himalayas, whom I met actually in Pennsylvania. From that personal practice came the desire to share what we learned. I have been gifted in being able to transform the power of fear and anger and selfish desires. Not completely, but increasingly I'm no longer hijacked by them in a debilitating way that causes me tremendous pain. And, I felt better physically, mentally, emotionally, and even spiritually. And we just wanted to share that with folks. And so we wanted to be relevant. We wanted to be current. So we started the American Meditation Institute. And from my classes on the material came an outline for the book. And then it took me a couple of years to flesh it out and put some teaching stories to it, and I've been revising it ever since it first came out in 05.
Where are you physically?
We are in upstate New York, about 12 miles east of Albany, between Albany, New York, and Williamstown, Massachusetts, in the foothills of the beautiful Berkshire Mountains.
You lucky ducky.
It's a beautiful area. It's very feminine area. It's these rolling hills that are very inviting and very comforting, and it's a great place to live. It's a great place to work and study and practice. We're very blessed.
James Taylor hanging out? You get to see
him?
Not too far
as the crow flies, probably about 25 or 30 miles just east of us.
There, your house's restaurant? The old house restaurant? So talk about the different chapters and sort of give us how you structured this book, yoga philosophy, and then we got into mantra science. And what is a mantra? Let me ask you, what is a mantra?
Well,
what's your
mantra?
If you don't mind sharing.
Is a word or a series of words containing the name of the Supreme Reality. Mantra is considered a perfect harmonic, if you will, okay, that represents perfection. If you listen to a mantra and you really give it your full attention, the one thing that you begin to become aware of is that before you hear the mantra, there's just silence. after the mantra concludes, there's silence. And so the more that you give your one-pointed attention, when you give your one-pointed attention, the more that you're able to train the mind to give its attention to the mantra begins to lead you beyond the boundaries of thinking, beyond the boundaries of feeling, and it winds up in the silence. And because the mind is one-pointed on the mantra, the mind too then goes into the silence, and we experience the silence. Now, to describe what the silence is very difficult, if not impossible, because we can only use words, we can only use concepts. The experience is different from the concept, but what the sages have said is that this silence is peace, happiness, and bliss. It's an experience of consciousness, observing consciousness without any uninvited object, like a thought or an emotion. And so mantra becomes the leader that takes you into that experience of silence, where consciousness observes consciousness without an object, and that ocean of consciousness is the same ocean of consciousness as that is within me and that is within you, Paul.
It's mm-hmm.
So that consciousness that is within you, that is within me, is part of an ocean of consciousness into which gross and subtle objects appear for limited periods of space and time, with which we have relationships, with which we must act, which will bring about consequences. So these gross objects that appear in our consciousness are things like our telephone, like our automobile, like our own body. Our own body is just a gross object appearing in our awareness with which we have a relationship, with which we must act, and those actions are going to bring about consequences. Thoughts are subtle objects. They're subtle because they resonate at a higher frequency than a body or an apple, and the senses can't pick up subtle thoughts, desires, and emotions. But we become aware of them, and we have relationships with them through our mind. And so the question becomes, what are the thoughts that I'm going to give my attention to? Because even a thought is a veritable action that brings about a consequence. So I like to think of it in terms of arithmetic or mathematics, a formula. Okay, so I look at the equal sign, and the equal sign always was a tip-off that on one side of the equal sign was going to be the same as on the opposite side of the equal sign. So I always like to start out with the answer. What is on the right side of the equal sign? What do I really want? What's my deepest driving desire? And so on some level, every human being wants to be happy, we want to be healthy, we want to be secure, we want loving, nurturing relationships. So that's the goal on the right side of the equation. On the left side, what is it that will lead me to that happiness and that health and that security? Well, what's on the left side are all the actions that I take, all the words that I speak, and all the thoughts that I think. And if we can create a group of thoughts, words, and actions through our lives that are in harmony with our own inner wisdom, the wisdom that is accessible by every human being through our conscience, which in yoga science it's referred to as the buddhi, if we can base our thoughts, words, and actions on our own inner wisdom, like Shakespeare suggests, then the consequence is always going to lead me for my highest and greatest good. I'll experience happiness, I'll experience health, I'll experience security to the fullest extent possible. But if my thoughts, words, and actions are in conflict with my inner wisdom, then the consequences that flow from those thoughts, words, and deeds will create some form of pain, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. And if we don't heed the lesson of pain at a low decibel level, the decibel level just gets louder and louder and louder until we're ready to make a mid-course correction and sacrifice some attachment to some fear or some anger or some selfish desire that part of the personality, the ego, the senses, the unconscious mind, would prefer to hold on to as opposed to let go of. So that sort of is a general definition of what yoga is. Yoga, which means union, is seen as a metaphoric bridge. It's a philosophical bridge. It's a scientific bridge that connects our outer actions with our inner wisdom. And the more that we can base our outer actions on our inner wisdom, we will be able to fulfill the purpose of our lives without pain, misery, and bondage. If our outer actions, thoughts, words, and deeds are in conflict with our inner wisdom and there's no philosophical or scientific bridge in our life, then there'll be conflict in the mind. And inner conflict, inner mental conflict, is the mother of all problems. Because if there's conflict in the mind, there has to be conflict outside the mind. And the first experience that we have, the first relationship that we have that's quote-unquote outside the mind, is the body. So the body starts yelling at us and saying, oh, gee, I'm in pain. I have a pain in my shoulder. I have a pain in my back. My blood pressure is high. But the symptoms of pain are not the problem. They're just the symptom. The problem is the conflict that exists. So if we can ameliorate the conflict, it's not necessary for the pain to manifest. So that was interesting to me because I always dealt with a lot of fear. I remember I spoke to a teacher once many, many years ago, and I was an art dealer. And in fact, I still am an art dealer. I make a living selling art. I don't make a living selling meditation classes. But I said to this teacher and a colleague, Eknath Ishwaran, I said, you know, I love this teaching. I had been practicing for years at that point. I said, but I'm self-employed. And I have to deal with a lot of fear. I sell paintings for a living, and I don't know for months on end when the next check is going to come in. I said to him, I thought that possibly meditation and yoga science would be better and easier for people who work for the government. They have a check coming in every week. They have they have health insurance. They have a pension. Then, with all of those positive things in their lives, that will give them plenty of time to learn a meditation. So I said, my problem is that I'm self-employed. And he looked at me with a little twinkle in his eye, and he said, well, your problem is that you think that you're self-employed. He said, I'm employed by the self. And the light went on inside my head. I said, oh, he's employed by the self. In other words, he bases his outer actions on his own inner wisdom. Well, I can do that. I'll start experimenting with my fear and see if I can't sacrifice my fear by serving my inner wisdom and transforming the fear. And that's what I began doing. And I was able to transform the debilitating, contractive power of fear into positive energy, willpower, and creativity, because fear is just energy. And we know from fifth grade that you can't create it, you can't destroy it, but you can transform it. Ice can be melted into water, and water can be heated into gas. So fear is not bad. Anger is not bad. Greed is not bad. It's just the wrong form of energy. Sacrifice is the mechanism for transformation. So if I gave you, Paul, if I gave you 20 gallons of crude oil from Saudi Arabia, and I put it into your automobile, why, you'd be very upset. Because it would wreck your engine. It might cost you $5,000 or $10,000 to have the engine overhauled because crude oil doesn't work in a combustion engine. But if I took that crude oil and I sent it to a refinery in Texas, asked them to refine it into gasoline and brought it back and then put it into your gasoline tank, you'd be very pleased. You could drive around for 300 or 400 miles. It's the same with fear and anger and self-willed desires. Relationships come to us that dislodge a little bubble from one of the channels in our unconscious mind. So I might be traveling on a highway. I'm going 55 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. I'm driving into work, and some fella who is not paying attention, maybe he's thinking about an argument that he had with his child or his wife that morning, and he cuts me off in traffic, and I have to slam on the brake to avoid an accident, and a bubble comes forward from my unconscious mind into my conscious mind, and I am aware of anger. Well, what am I going to do with it? If I serve it, it's going to poison my entire physiology. I might act irrationally without discrimination, and that's going to be a potentially a problem. But if I can sacrifice it, first of all, the channel from which it came in my unconscious mind is made more shallow. And the anger that came forward can be transformed into energy, willpower, and creativity simply by sacrificing it, offering it back to the origin from which it came. So meditation is a engineering science. When we meditate and we learn to do all of the allied disciplines of meditation, what we're doing is we're re-engineering the software of the mind. And that's a beautiful thing.
Well, Leonard, meditation is not initially so easy. I think that, you know, if somebody can, in essence, when you share the way to consider meditating, do you suggest them to clear their mind? How do you go about helping somebody to meditate? Because I think most people say they can't take their mind off of everything that's in front of their nose and everything going on in their life for more than 5 or 10 seconds. What is a way to do that?
Well, what I do is I ask that person, what do you love to do? What do you love to do, I say to them. And I remind them, I'm not asking you what do you like. I'm asking you what do you love. And they might say, I love hiking in the mountains. I love fishing. I love reading a good book. I love a great movie. I love a gourmet a meal. Mm-hmm. I love sex. Okay? So what's happening to your mind when you're engaged in something that you love? And from a yogic perspective, what's happening is all of the energy of your mind automatically is being focused down to one point to the exclusion of every other thought. So when you're reading a fantastic book, you say you love it because all of your mental energy is focused on the words and the story. Same for a movie, same for a painting, same for some people, it's going to Vegas, you see. For some people, it's buying a new pair of shoes. So we already have the experience of really emptying our mind with one exception, whatever's right in front of me that I love. Okay, so how do you get to love something? You learn to love something by training the mind to be one-pointed. And it's, you know, it's a little bit like going to school, because nobody from grade school or high school or college or post-grad, nobody ever taught us to use the mind. All that we have been taught by our educational system is to memorize, assimilate, and regurgitate. And then we get a diploma, because they say, okay, well, you've passed all the curriculum, and now you can get a job. But the mind is still untrained. So meditation teaches us slowly, lovingly, compassionately, to just focus on the mantra to the exclusion of anything else. So if any other thought, image, or sound comes into your awareness during the training process, during your meditation process, you don't push it away, because that's injurious. You're not angry because you think that you're a failure. That's not kind. You simply honor and witness whatever the distracting thought is, and you offer it back to the origin from which it came. When I say offer it back to the origin from which it came, from a yogic perspective, there's only one reality. It's the limitation of the brain and the senses that sees multiplicity. But the truth is, everything is one holistic organism. And that's what quantum physics and physicists are telling us. Everything is a shimmering vibration of particles and molecules. And so when you offer back the distraction and then redirect your attention back to the mantra, you're doing several things. You're creating this skill of one-pointed attention, number one, which will increase your love for the process. Number two, you're learning detachment. You're learning to create a space between the stimulus and the response. In that space between stimulus and response, it provides you the freedom to check with your inner wisdom to determine whether this interceding thought is to be given attention to or sacrificed. Of course, going into your meditation, you know that only the mantra is to be given your attention, whether you're meditating for 1 minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes. And so therefore, when a thought comes, you honor it, you witness it, and you know already going in that during this meditation, during this training period, you're going to sacrifice that distracting thought. So that creates detachment. And it also cultivates discrimination. Because in life, when we're off of our meditation seat, we don't know from moment to moment or relationship to relationship whether a thought, a desire, an emotion, or a concept is appropriate to give attention to or not to give it attention. It's not a test at that point. It's real life. It's not training anymore. It's real life. So if we can learn detachment between stimulus and response, that gives me the freedom of time to redirect my attention to my conscience, to what Sanskrit refers to as the buddhi. Now, that's a major function of the mind, the conscience. It operates as a mirror. It has the capacity, our conscience, unlike any other animal. Human beings have a conscience. It's part of the mind. It can reflect wisdom from the superconscious portion of the mind. The superconscious portion of the mind, it's outside the matrix. It's beyond the conscious mind. It's beyond the unconscious mind. The superconscious mind is the same portion of the mind where Albert Einstein saw mathematical equations. It's the same portion of the mind where Paul McCartney hears beautiful melodies. Doesn't mean that Paul is going to become a physicist, and it doesn't mean that Leonard's going to become a songwriter. It means that the more that I use my conscience, use the buddhi, to determine my thoughts, my words, and my actions in relationship, then I will be enhanced physically, mentally, and emotionally, and creatively. And that leads then to willpower. Through this process, I am building the muscles of will to do what's to be done and not do what's not to be done. Because if the truth were told, the problem that we have, the challenge, is not one of IQ. There are many, 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 many brilliant people with great IQs. IQ is not the issue. WQ is the issue. WQ is will quotient. We don't have the will to do what's to be done or not do what's not to be done. Because in our culture, the gurus of our culture, and when I speak of the gurus of our culture, I'm talking about Madison Avenue copywriters, because they're always saying that if it looks pleasant and it smells pleasant and it tastes pleasant and it sounds pleasant and it feels pleasant, buy it and you'll be happy. Well, sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not true. So how do you know? Shakespeare, again, says, "To thine own self be true." So the more that we can base our outer actions on our inner wisdom, build a bridge of yoga, whatever you call it. You could call it Christianity, you could call it Judaism, you could call it Islam, you could call it Buddhism, you could call it Hinduism, you could call it Native American tradition. But every human being needs a full philosophy of life, a bridge that connects our outer actions to our inner wisdom. And the more that we can do that, life begins to become poetry and song.
Let me ask you just a couple of questions. One is the mantra. Does everybody have create their own mantra? Or in your case, what do you have a mantra that you personally use that
yes,
you don't share with others?
Yes,
is a mantra a personal consideration?
Well, that depends on the situation. So I wrote this book, The Heart and Science of Yoga. And in The Heart and Science of Yoga, there's a list of mantras from the world's great spiritual traditions: Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam. And so I don't have a personal relationship with everybody that's going to read the book who is going to begin to meditate. So I provide mantras from different traditions that those traditions and the sages from those traditions promise that they work. Okay? And so I ask them to choose that. If somebody has an affinity for this teaching and for the way that Leonard teaches, and they contact me and I develop a personal relationship, at that point, I could gift them their own personal mantra from a science of mantras. There is a whole science of mantra that the teacher bestows upon a student at a specific time for a specific purpose. So there's a couple of different answers to your question.
Okay. Let me ask you two last questions. I love listening and hearing and thinking while you're doing all of that about my life. And actually, I'm a yoga instructor.
Oh, is that right?
Certified, yes.
Great.
And a spiritual minister. So we're talking very important thinking and that I share with you as well. I want to ask two last questions that I ask everyone. One is, what's good news for Leonard in any aspect of your life? What would be good news for you?
Well, what good news is skillfully being in service to the truth that comes to me through my conscience. So I know at this point in my life that as long as my outer actions can conform to my own inner wisdom, I know I'm being led in an appropriate, safe, loving, nurturing manner. And that's the best news that I can experience.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
And our last question is, I've asked many because we're very involved with the International Day of Peace, which is September 21st.
Yeah.
The 193 countries agreed to a day of peace.
Yes.
And we do a whole bunch of functions here in New York. I'm inviting you now to an event in Central Park and Times Square and so on. What does peace mean to you?
Peace means an evenness of mind, where my consciousness is not agitated by ignorance that primarily that I am a separate individual. That's an old paradigm. In the ancient Hebrew tradition, which gave birth to Christianity and Islam, the core of all three of those world religions is based on a prayer from Deuteronomy that is called the Shema. The first sentence translated from the Hebrew into the English is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord God is one." So instead of operating under a paradigm of duality, where I am the subject and everything that my brain and senses can perceive is an object outside of me, what the ancient Hebrew tradition and Christian traditions and Islamic traditions understood and tried to practice was, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord God, the whole supreme reality, the whole enchilada is really one. Okay, so there is no two. It's like in mathematics when we learned numbers, the number three doesn't really exist. There is no three. It's just a concept that indicates that one has appeared three times. Number five is one five times. And so if I can live my life based on that and base my outer actions on my inner wisdom, my mind is going to be even. And so if that's the case, then there will be peace in my consciousness. And if I change my consciousness, because there is only one consciousness, it changes the entire consciousness of the planet. So you can imagine if I started meditating and started purifying my own instrument of fear and anger and self-willed desire, and Paul did, and Susie did, and Sharon did, and even Donald did, why, you know, it's beyond our imagination, the potential that we have.
Sounds good, Leonard. Thank you. The book is called The Heart and Science of Yoga, Empowering Self-Care Program for a Happy, Healthy, Joyful Life, the American Meditation Institute. What's your website?
It's americanmeditation.org.
Okay, my friend. Thank you so much for sharing good news. It was a real pleasure.
It was a pleasure for me. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, thank you. Home.